Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Global Health Forum on Blog Talk Radio. This show is a public service of people to people, a not-for-profit 501c3 registered Ethiopian diaspora healthcare organization. I'm your host, Dr. Antan Ahapte, Chairman of People to People's Board of Directors. This evening we'll be discussing autism spectrum disorder, a neurodevelopmental disorder which affects roughly about 1 in 68 children in the United States. 3.5 million Americans live with an autism spectrum disorder. The prevalence of this disorder has been rapidly increasing, with the Center for Disease Control estimating being about 30% higher in 2014 than it was in 2012. Autism spectrum disorder occurs in all racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic groups, but is almost five times more common in boys than in girls. The worldwide prevalence is estimated at 1%, although accurate data for all countries is hard to come by. The total expenditure for autism in the United States is estimated at $250 billion annually and is expected to top $400 billion in another 10 years. It's obvious, then, autism spectrum disorder is a growing public health challenge affecting ever-increasing number of children, and with a heavy emotional, psychological, physical, and financial toll on the children, parents, and society in general. What can be done to curb this rapid growth in prevalence? What can we do to ensure early intervention so that affected children can have a happy and productive life? What are the services available to these families, and what are the special education laws in the various states? My two expert guests this evening will help us shed some light on these questions and other aspects of the autism spectrum disorder, which includes autistic disorder, pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified, and Asperger's syndrome. Leah Siyum Tasfa is a registered nurse, nurse practitioner in obstetrics and gynecology, and an autism advocate and researcher based in Dallas, Texas. She's the founder and president of Reach Families, a nonprofit organization that supports, educates, and empowers families from East Africa raising children with various disabilities. She's also the founder and chairperson of FUSE, Families United for Special Education Services in our school district. Welcome to the Global Health Forum, Leah.
Thank you.
And Dr. Kristen Dooley is a licensed psychologist and licensed specialist in school psychology, currently a professional member of the Special Needs Resource Team at the Jewish Family Service of Greater Dallas. She has worked in various school districts in Dallas and the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center for Autism and Related Disorders. Welcome to the show, Dr. Dooley.
Thank you very much.
Okay, let me start with you, Dr. Dooley. Can you explain to our audience what autism spectrum disorder means and what the accepted definition and how the diagnosis is made?
Sure. The specific definition of autism spectrum disorders would be a set of complex disorders of brain development which are characterized by difficulties in social interaction, verbal and nonverbal communication, and then the presence of repetitive patterns of behavior. So recently, researchers and clinicians have begun using the term autisms or autism spectrum disorders with the new diagnostic criteria instead of using autistic disorder to kind of the collection of disorders that have this common clinical manifestation. And so what we know is that the incidence rate seems to be about 1 in 64 children. So that would be 1 in 42 boys and 1 in 189 girls. That's the latest CDC statistics. And the diagnostic criteria actually changed for autism spectrum disorders in May of 2013, where, as you said at the beginning of the program, where there used to be the pervasive developmental disorders, autistic disorders, and Asperger's disorders, now the new criteria kind of brings all of those together under autism spectrum disorders And then there are different severity levels of classifying functional levels.
Go ahead.
No, please. No. I was just going to talk about kind of the early diagnosis, but please, mm-hmm. go ahead.
All right. So I was just going to mention, as you said, you know, those are the autism spectrum disorder as classified in 2013 on DSM-5. And then there's the WHO International Classification of Diseases that has Asperger's as a distinct entity. So I was wondering whether you can explain what the two conditions have in common and what is different.
The real crux of both of them is that you would have to have a social communication impairment and then also restrictive repetitive patterns of behavior. So those are kind of you would need, a persistent deficit in social communication and social interaction, and that would be across multiple settings. And then, the presence of these restricted or repetitive patterns of behavior, interests, or activities. So that could include, more of this stereotyped rocking behaviors or, quote-unquote, flapping of hands, all the way to kind of intense interest in specific subject areas, which can often be video games or just a variety of different interests.
Okay. And Leah, before I go into all the activities you're involved in currently with autism, I want to take you back to your presentation during our annual P2P conference last September. I remember you sharing your personal story and about your twin boys were diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. Tell us how that unfolded. What were the red flags for you when it first started?
First of all, thank you, Dr. Antenna, and people for inviting me to talk about this subject that's dear to my heart. I have, like you said, I have two children who are on this autism spectrum disorder. They were diagnosed very early, about 2.5 to 3 years of age. And being a nurse and my husband being a neurologist, actually, we didn't pick it up. We did not recognize those early symptoms of autism. They were premature. They were born at 32 weeks. And they developed normally as far as physically and being able to eat and a lot of things. But then speech was one of the things that kind of alerted us. But thinking that this is maybe related to their prematurity, we didn't really think there was something wrong. And to be quite honest, at that time, even being a nurse, my thinking of autism is those kids sitting in a corner playing with their hands and not being affectionate. And then there was that was thinking back then that it was something like when the mother's not the refrigerator mom syndrome, and I knew I was very in touch with my children and very affectionate, that I said that cannot be autism. So that was a difficult when we finally realized, and I pushed him with, you know, to get what is wrong with these children. By the time they got to almost 3 years old, we actually got the diagnosis through the school district. Our pediatrician also was kind of hesitant to push that. He was saying they're preemies, they're boys, and we always think boys speak later. And then there's also this language. We were speaking Amharic to them at home. And we just kind of, part of it could have been denial. We just didn't want to get the diagnosis. To be quite honest, I didn't think about autism. And we took them to the school district a little earlier than 3 years. They were able to alert me that there's something wrong. So that's because our journey with autism, to answer your question, and I can tell you more about what I do later on.
Sure. But this is mm-hmm. very revealing when both parents were professionals, could not, you know, readily make the diagnosis. As you say, you know, there's mom syndrome always lurking behind. So you can only imagine how difficult it would be for non-professionals. So in your experience, who sounds the alarm first? Is it the parents, the pediatricians, teachers? What is your experience with
Okay. In my experience, and again, there's usually it's moms who pick it up. Even in our case, I picked it up, and to be quite honest, about 18 months, I suspected something, but being surrounded by people in the medical field, unfortunately, it was that back then we didn't look for autism as much as we do now. We were, you know, and then with the, like I said, with prematurity and stuff. But usually it's the mom. In my training, I trained with a neurologist who's very experienced in autism. And what she says, when the mom says something, I listen. So usually there's mom's instincts. In some cases, I've had dads who also pick it up. But rarely is it the pediatrician, unfortunately, to say. I'm disappointed with the pediatrician. Usually, because, you know, the visit that we do to a pediatrician is so short, unless we do something geared to autism, like MCHAT or those the screening tests, usually a pediatrician don't pick it up as early as 18 months or 20 months. We're doing better, though. Now, I know a lot of pediatricians are now doing the MCHAT routinely, and I think it's required in some states to do it. So, but usually it's moms.
Okay. All right. Okay. That's a good segue to your current roles and responsibilities. Can you tell us about what you do as an advocate and researcher in the autism spectrum disorder arena?
Okay. I do, like you read my some of the stuff that I do. I primarily work with families that have children with autism and other disabilities in the Ethiopian community. Now in the Dallas, I have a support group, and it's a nonprofit organization where I go and speak at the different churches, different organizations, any kind of meeting, mahavar, anything where they allow me to speak about early intervention and the early signs of autism. And once families come to me with those symptoms, I kind of help them connect it to the school system, to the medical system, to the state, all the services these families can access to help their children. As far as in the school district also, I do some advocacy work where I educate parents about how to work with the school districts and how to access services. Currently, I also have a part-time job working with adults with autism and other disabilities, accessing services and providing, as a nurse, providing services to them.
Okay. Going back to you, Dr. Dooley, what do you think is the explanation for the significant increase in cases of autism spectrum disorder diagnosed over the last several decades? Is it increased awareness and early diagnosis, or is it more cases?
I think most researchers and clinicians would probably say a combination of both. I think not long ago when if someone were to ask that, I don't think that we have many answers to why there does seem to be an increase, and it does appear that there is a larger incidence of autism spectrum disorders in the community. But I think what we do know is that there does seem to be a genetic component to the disorder, and that in addition to that, there do seem to be some kind of environmental components as well. Usually those environmental components are kind of in the prenatal environment. Some risk factors could be like increased age of parents. It could be maternal illness during pregnancy. Again, we don't fully understand, but most people would kind of agree that there does seem to be a combination with genetic risk factors.
Go ahead.
Going back to what Leah was saying, I completely agree that about parents kind of being the first people to identify that there are issues. I think health providers are being, I don't think there was a lot of education a while ago about how to detect early autism signs. And I think we know, I think we're trying to understand that more and more and provide trainings in medical schools and then in hospital environments and pediatric offices. So the American Academy of Pediatrics has been great to kind of help with those guidelines for what providers, when a provider should kind of do those screenings in their office. But absolutely, mothers kind of have a sense of that something seems to be wrong. And when you talk to parents, mothers sometimes have people say that it's all in their head, that they're just kind of anxious or just worried. And I think it's important as providers that we really listen to parents and listen to mothers in particular.
Right. And then I was going to mention that I have read some studies which showed about most like a 90% chance of an identical twin being affected if the other twin has autism spectrum disorder. And then and also about a 5% chance if another sibling is affected. So almost certainly some genetic factors. And as you mentioned, environmental
right.
factors, which have not as yet been isolated, but both prenatal and immediately after birth, maybe. And then coming back to you, Leah, what is the magnitude of the problem in the immigrant population, at least in the East African immigrant population in the area you're active?
Okay. Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. Actually, you kind of had given me an opportunity earlier when I talked about my research. In 2013, I had an opportunity to do a training at UT Health Science Center in Houston. It's called LEND Program. And as a fellow, I had an opportunity to do research. And I looked at, because I'm working with the immigrant population, especially Ethiopian, Eritrean, and some Somali and Kenyan population in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, I just felt there was a lot more in our population than other communities. And within that time, the study from Minnesota on the Somali population came out. I don't know if you're familiar with that. There's a heavy Somali population in Minnesota, and CDC Autism Speaks, and I believe NIH also was involved in that study. They realized there is a higher incidence in the Somali population. So I looked, I did my own study in Texas looking at the East African population. What I looked at was mine was not as good as good data as theirs in Minnesota. Of course, mine was limited to educational services. Theirs was, they looked at all medical records, educational records, and other government service data as well. In my study, I found that there was a higher incidence in the Ethiopian population in Texas. And we looked at studies. My study looked at language spoken at home, and then that correlated with how much of those kids that speak Amharic, Tigrinya, Somali had autism. And my study showed 1 in 30 children in some of the population. The Somali study reflected the same thing, 1 in 32 Somali children, 1 in 20 boys of Somali descent had autism. And in my study, I found similar findings. So this tells me that there is more East Africans being diagnosed with autism. And there, in my study, I was not able to see any other things other than that the child was diagnosed with autism. Whereas the study in Minnesota looked at other things like cognitive disability. Cognitive disability would indicate a severe case of autism. Most of the children that have cognitive disability also have other comorbid conditions. And in the Somali study, 100% of the children that identified with autism also had cognitive disability. So that tells you the magnitude in our population. These are not Asperger's type of children. These are children that are significantly affected. And then when I was talking to Dr. Dooley the other day, we were talking about diagnosis and getting the diagnosis. And I tell her, in my population, usually it's not really hard because it is a more severe form of autism. So not to say there aren't children that have milder forms of autism in our population. One of my sons happened to have a milder form of autism. But a majority of our children are more significantly affected, and they have comorbid conditions like seizures, gastrointestinal problems, and other conditions. Mm-hmm. So it is very difficult. You can imagine being an immigrant living in America, learning the language, learning to adjust, and then having a child with significant disability and having to access services. So I would say it's really harder on our population, in our community, and that's why we need to do a lot of awareness, and then I hope we'll address stigma down the road, and the isolation that comes with having a child with disability. It's really something that really needs to be addressed as a community.
Any theories to explain this discrepancy, not only in increased prevalence, but apparently increased severity too?
The severity, we are, I'm going to mention this also later on. I'm working with a researcher at NIH, an Ethiopian researcher, geneticist, that we're going to look at possibly planning on, we're planning to do a study to see at what are the genetic, what does it look like in Ethiopians? So I'm really excited about that work. We are just barely in the talking stages right now. As far as the causes, there is autism in Ethiopia. There is cases of autism now. But looking at some of the research, there's something environmental that these children are facing when they come to Western world. Definitely, because in the Somali population call it the disease of the America or disease of Sweden. Because in Somalia, even in Ethiopia, there's no word for the word autism. Growing up in Ethiopia, I did not know anybody that has a child with autism, and my parents did not know anybody. But now, you can't, I mean, there's so many Ethiopians I meet on a daily basis, they know somebody that has a child with autism. What is that? Definitely, there's a lot of studies being done. I am not an anti-vaccine person, but there is enough research has not been done in that area, because that's one thing that we know we are exposed, our children are exposed routinely on since they're little, since they're very young. So that's the area that I think could be for some group of children. I'm not saying all children with autism are vaccine injured, but that is the area also, one of the areas that subgroup of these children could have been, because I say that because working with a lot of families and hearing their stories, hearing that how, when they realize their child has autism, in some cases, the child was doing really well after the vaccination, there's fever, there's seizures, and then the child was never the same. So these are those cases. And then there's, like Dr. Dooley said, there's a lot of autism, and those are also the genetics, the different genetic makeup of the different autism. So we need to look in that area also and think who might be, it might not be, maybe other environmental factors, the food, the insecticides and pollution, all that could have played a role in some of these children.
Right, and just to add on to that, what we do know is that these autism spectrum disorders seem to be across race, ethnicity. They seem to occur in all countries, although there are varying ranges of how they're identified in those countries. And then I think, as Leah pointed out, there's been so much in the media about vaccinations and I think what parents should do and what they shouldn't do, and parents are scared. January, with information that they were advocating that all children should be vaccinated. As Lee and I talked about this the other day, I think what we want to encourage parents to do is to talk with their healthcare providers, talk with their pediatrician, that there could be options instead of not being vaccinated, maybe spacing out these vaccinations. But absolutely, the research that we have seems to suggest that there is no linkage, but clearly it warrants further discussion.
Right, right. And then as Leah mentioned, I mean, there's a big Ethiopian population in the greater Washington metro area. And then, you know, we all hear about anecdotal cases of parents who are absolutely convinced that the, vaccination has something to do with it. It has always been a hot button issue. But, so how do you balance?
Right. Just to clarify that, not only within the Ethiopian community, I think there's anecdotal, I think other parents that I see in the clinic also kind of there's a subset that seem to also indicate that. But again,
yeah. I mean, the question is how to balance this legitimate fear that parents have about, you know, inadvertently increasing their children's risk factor for autism, and the real danger of not having them immunized. I mean, the recent outbreak at Disney World in California is a case in point, where about they had 100 cases of measles. Substantial number were unvaccinated or undervaccinated. You know, there was the pertussis whooping cough epidemic in 2012, and now several states are discussing, you know, legislation about tightening allowed exemption from immunizations. So this is kind of a delicate balance, and I'm sure comes up a lot in your advocacy work.
It does.
Yes, I think
for
both of us, right, Leah?
Yes, it does. It's something that comes up again and again, and you know, parents have to be informed and, you know, and make the right decision for the right child. I do not push one way or another, but let's look. And then spacing out vaccinations. When the child is sick, when she's not feeling good, that's not the time to vaccinate. There's a lot of things that I think parents need to be educated about vaccination and all other healthcare issues.
And the other thing worth pointing out as far as vaccination goes is that, you know, thimerosal, which was a mercury product, was the one that was kind of mostly implicated, and that's no longer used in most vaccines, except maybe for influenza. So that may be another thing to kind of reassure patients. But going about the severity level of autism spectrum disorder and the corresponding functional deficits, Dr. Dooley, can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, sure. Well, in the new criteria that the Diagnostics and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM-5, the fifth edition, when you make a diagnosis, you have to clarify whether the autism spectrum disorder is with or without an accompanying intellectual impairment. As Leah kind of talked about before, that it's very common for there to be cognitive difficulties and mental retardation, but again, not for all. And then whether there is an accompanying language impairment. And previously, I think there's been a lot of, with the diagnosis of Asperger's disorder, in the previous criteria, people would say that you could not present with a language impairment. But what we were finding in the research and with clinical work was that higher functioning individuals with autism that were classified as Asperger's disorder really did have language impairments, but it was more within social communication or that pragmatic language. And then whether or not the autism is accompanied by a medical or genetic condition, or behavioral disorders or other comorbid mental health issues, which are very common. And then as you specified there, as you talked about, you have three different severity levels. So you could have a level one where the individual requires some support in place to kind of be more successful in the environment. Or there's a level two where they're actually requiring substantial support. And then the level three is requiring very substantial support. I think some of the controversy in the new criteria is that kind of language seems to be a little bit vague. But that's the current criteria and levels of severity.
You both mentioned, I mean, early diagnosis is very crucial, and in the availability of services early on. But what advice do you have about balancing sometimes the stigma that sometimes comes with the diagnosis of, autism spectrum disorder and the support and resources that follow the diagnosis?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question.
I'll take that one from our community. As you know, there's a lot of stigma around mental illness and autism or any kind of illnesses in our community, especially when it comes to our children. To be honest, there is no balance. I mean, you've got to overcome the stigma to get the services. Mm-hmm. Those kids need services now. yesterday, as soon as they're diagnosed. So what I talk to families about is this is not a time to hide something. This is something the children need services. We got to knock on different doors. We got to really go after to get the services, because early intervention makes a lot of difference for some of these children. Everybody benefits from early intervention, but some kids with early intervention, they make a lot of improvement within a year, within a 2 years, from non-speaking, non-being, non-verbal. They're verbal. They're able to attend school. They're able to be included if they get their early intervention. So in our community, as you say, as you know, people are worried about what people at church would say, people at neighborhood would say. I would say we have to educate our friends and family. This is what my child has. This is what I need to do. I need to go ahead and get the services. Pray with me. Stay with me. And I tell families, stay positive. If there's people in your life that are negative, drop them and stay with the people that mm-hmm. are positive, because your kids need a lot of your energy and your time. You don't have time to be spending arguing with people mm-hmm. about what your child doesn't have, because a lot in our family would say, no, don't say that. No, don't say that. You don't have, your child doesn't have that, because the people, and people feed on the denial families have. And I say, that's not the way to look at it. Even if they, let's get them services, even if they don't have autism, good. These are good things for any child, the services, the therapies that are provided. So that's the way I advise and I counsel families when it comes to stigma.
Very well said, very well said. We're almost halfway through our program and we'll be opening up the phone line soon. I'd like to remind our audience that you're listening to the Global Health Forum, a public service by people to people. I'm your host, Dr. Antana Haptain. My guests this evening are Leah Siyum Tasfa, who's an advocate and researcher in autism spectrum disorder. Leah recently completed fellowship training in leadership education in autism and neurodevelopmental disorders at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston, Texas, with a research focus on the prevalence of autism in the children of immigrant families from East Africa. Leah sits in the boards of several local and statewide organizations that serve individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And Dr. Kristen Dooley is a licensed psychologist and licensed specialist in school psychology, dedicated to expanding diagnostic and treatment services for children and adolescents with autism and developmental disabilities. Her clinical interests are centered on early childhood mental health, neurodevelopmental disabilities, and autism spectrum disorders. Dr. Dooley is a frequent speaker in various forums and is the co-author of the book Best Practices in School Neuropsychology. We invite you to be an active participant of the show. You can ask your questions or share your comments by dialing 646-595-4742. Press 1 if you'd like to speak, and you can also email your questions and comments to info@peoplepeople.org. So let me start with an email question I got from Saba from Silver Spring. And she's asking if Asperger's be diagnosed as new after age 10. She says, my daughter is having increasing difficulty making friends and her interest in space exploration is getting so intense that she does not want to do anything else.
Actually, Lee and I were just talking about this the other day when we were talking about diagnosis, and that absolutely, I think that particularly for children, adolescents that are higher functioning, that were not identified early, I think difficulties come usually when there are higher social demands. So a lot of times what you find is that children that haven't been identified at an earlier age tend to have problems in third grade, whether it's maybe more academic rigor, or there's more requirements. And then certainly fifth grade, a transition to middle school, and then the transition to high school. I even have worked with many people that have not been diagnosed until they start to enter college, so that transition into young adulthood. So it's not uncommon at all for children and adolescents to be identified at later ages, particularly now that we know more.
Okay. All right. Let me go ahead and take a call from 703-566. Go ahead, please.
Good evening. And ladies, you make some very compelling arguments and very interesting points. I am a parent of a 13-year-old boy who is on the autism spectrum, And in the last 13 years, we've had a very interesting journey. What I do find interesting and is the prevalence, as Leah said earlier, of people, parents in our community who are in denial or assume that they'll outgrow this, and education is a key component. And in whenever I've had the opportunity, and whether it's in small groups or individually, I've advocated for early intervention and talk to your pediatrician, talk to somebody at school. How do we go beyond that? I live in the D.C. metro area, and there is a large community of parents, some who are still in denial, hoping that, they'll just outgrow this, and others who, out of shame, out of lack of resources, out of, whatever the case may be, are not providing services for them. So how do you, or what do you recommend as a best course of action?
I'll take that question because I deal with that on a daily basis. Sometimes parents are referred to me from others, and they tell me somebody has a child who looks like autism. Would you go talk to them? And I try my best to be very diplomatic, but there's some times that I am very direct and say, we don't do anything, it's going to get worse. Another thing that I say, what's going to happen to this child when you no longer are alive, because we have limited time. So we need to give them the services, the interventions now that we can, and move on. And the stigma, like I said earlier, that's just holding us. And I think explaining that to the families that hiding this information, hiding the services is not harming our children long term. Like I said, I talk to a lot of families, and I go to the churches and talk about these are the symptoms, these are the things, and this is what we can do. Call me. If you don't know how to do this, call me. I'll come with you. I'll come to the school. And I'll tell you, one of the unfortunate things in the schools is, especially for the higher functioning kids, if you don't insist, the schools sometimes just look away. Until that kid gets into trouble, like Christine said, maybe in middle school or high school, things go awry and the kid gets in trouble. That's when we just start looking at what could be wrong with this child. So even the more severe cases, the schools usually pick it up because the kid is going to have to be educated in special education, what we call self-contained classroom. But the kids that are academically doing well and everything, they're not diagnosed. But these kids, we're finding out even if they end up going to college, they're going to struggle to find jobs because they haven't learned those social skills. They haven't learned those skills that help them survive independently outside of their family's homes. So that's just sometimes we just have to be direct with these families. Sometimes we have to be nice and presented, but there's times when you have to be directly tell them what the outcome is. So that's the way I have approached it. And sometimes it works. In some families, it takes them 2-3 years. And then lo and behold, one day I get a call and say, we're ready. We want you to help us. And there's a mom recently called me at 16. Then she's ready. We do our best. And then, let them make the decision.
I think that children, it's totally understandable, and I think it's not only in the Ethiopian community, but in other communities as well, where there's this stigma. And I think as parents, children are kind of, we kind of consider them extensions of ourselves in some way. And there's a lot of guilt. There's guilt that maybe we caused this, or guilt that we didn't do enough. Mothers have a lot of guilt of could they have done something in their pregnancy, I think Leah would agree that we try over and over to let parents know that you have not caused this. This is nothing that you've done. That unfortunately, again, there's this combination of genetic and environment factors that we're learning more and more about. But certainly, it places that family kind of in a vulnerable situation where they're asking for help, and some of their private information is being reported to professionals. But really, the earlier you can identify it and the earlier that you can receive treatment, a much better prognosis later on.
No, I do agree. My son was diagnosed, I think, at about 2.5, not quite 3, and he's shown a lot of progress, and especially in the last 4 or 5 years, he's shown a lot of progress, but there's still a lot of work ahead of us. Do you have, either one of you, do you have any resources that parents, wherever they may be on this particular journey, that they could access, that they could read, that they could, you know, I don't know, contact you? I'm not sure what how this plays out, but not just for myself, but there are a lot of parents who are, you know, in the same boat and sometimes feel they're drowning. I have a very good friend who, like Leah, she has twins, a boy and a girl.
Mm-hmm.
The boy is, I haven't seen him in a few years, but he showed remarkable progress over the course of 1 year, and then I think he plateaued. The daughter is typical, I think she's 8 years old now. They're 8 years old and, you know, typical kid.
Wow.
So do you have anything that you could share with us, whether it's online or otherwise, where parents could go?
I have a website. I need to update it. You're talking about documents in Amharic or in English, anything?
It doesn't matter. Anything,
okay.
You know, anything is better than nothing.
Okay. Let me give you my website, and then I would love to connect with you. If you can email me through that website, or I can give you, they can give you my phone number. I would definitely want to connect with somebody, with you, to help you reach out to other families, because I know you have a heart to do that. And I would even come to D.C. to come and stand by you as you speak to a lot of families, because that's where a lot of Ethiopians live, a lot of Eritreans live, and we need to connect. And another thing that I am in the process of doing is doing a phone conference with a lot of families with all disabilities in the United States. And I would love for you to participate in that also. So I need your contact information. But my website is reachfamilies.org, reachfamilies.org. I'm still working on it. You might not see a lot of things on it yet, but I'm working. We have a lot of documents translated. We have the MCHAP translated into Amharic, Tigrinya. There's also other documents that I'm putting up there. And I would definitely, like I said, connect with you and see what we can do.
And I would say that there's also Autism Speaks is a wonderful website where it kind of offers the early symptoms for parents to kind of identify in children if they're worried. There's a screening tool that you can use if you're concerned that your child may be exhibiting signs of autism spectrum disorder, and there's also a resource guide where if you enter your zip code wherever you are in the United States, it kind of will list different treatment centers that are near you. And then also, I think we were kind of talking about special education services before, and a website that I often give out to families, it's Rights Law, so it's WRIGHTS.com. And it talks about the rights that families have and special education law and accommodations that children can receive within the school setting.
Thank you.
I'll have to move on. Many callers on the line, but this is absolutely important work to do. And we at People to People would love to be part of the outreach and would love to be involved in the effort going forward. Let me take another call from area code 708.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. 708-975, please.
Hello?
Go ahead.
This is Kenpa, Dr. Gabello. I'm so glad to join you in this exchange of opinions and the exchange of knowledge and
go ahead. Are you still there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. For the gentleman that asked the reference, actually, one that I found really very helpful is that of the CDC publication, which has... Hello?
Hello, are you still there? Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I'm still there. I was going to help the gentleman to access www.cdc.gov. Act early.
I agree. That's a good website.
That's great. That's a very helpful website too. Okay. Let me take one more question from a caller. I have caller at 703-625. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Great discussion and useful information. I joined a little bit late, so I apologize if you've already addressed it. But you know, what are the typical treatments and what kind of prevention and do you, I mean, has there any cases where actually kids came out of it?
We actually haven't covered that. That's a good question. Leo, what do you think? Do you want to talk and I can maybe chime in after?
Okay. Treatments. I think treatment is going to be dependent on the child. Currently, applied behavior analysis, ABA, is one of the treatments to change behaviors, to teach them different things. Speech therapy is almost necessary for all children because there's speech delay or speech abnormality. Occupational therapy is something. There's also other interventions, dietary interventions that are helpful to some children that are, like I said, some of these kids have gastrointestinal problems. Depending on the child, what the symptoms are, there's other treatments to address those comorbid conditions. But primarily taking care of the social skills, the deficits that Dr. Dewey had mentioned, those are the areas that need treatment.
Right, I totally agree that what we know is that the behavioral interventions are probably what we have that are showing lots of progress for kids. And as Leah said, the applied behavior analysis, that ABA, seems to be the most effective and we have the most more evidence-based research on. And ABA has changed over the years, where before it was, I think some of the controversy was that it didn't generalize more pro-social behaviors, but now there's lots of different types and techniques involved in ABA, like there's pivotal response training. So it seems to be very effective. And then also, again, hopefully you would have an established relationship with your health provider because, as we talked about before, there's lots of comorbid issues with GI. There's often difficulties with sleep. There can be behavioral difficulties, particularly for kids that are nonverbal and have so-called aggressive behaviors. But when you treat those aggressive behaviors, you actually find that it's more a response to maybe some underlying anxiety or just frustration with lack of communication. So those are some of the treatments that we have. But it's early diagnosis, and the sooner that you can deliver these behavioral interventions like ABA, speech, occupational therapy, the better prognosis later on. There are cases where I think parents report where children sometimes, when they're later evaluated, well, criteria for an autism spectrum disorder, it seems to be very rare. But again, we don't know a lot more. I think we need further research. Children and adolescents with autism can grow up to lead very happy, successful lives, have good careers. So there's lots of hope.
Yeah, and to say that children come out of it, I think we've been hearing a lot of being cured, and I think in my experience, what happens is these kids might not be significantly affected with early interventions. They're able to change a lot of those behaviors, and I see in those kids a little bit quirkiness every now and then, but usually they are very well maintained, and it's hard sometimes to pick them up from other kids. And I think those are the children that people consider cured in.
Yeah,
that's my personal experience.
Right. I guess one of the confusions that come is that, you know, it's a spectrum of disorder. So, as you said, from very mild to severe. So the you know, idea of a cure may be confused, you know, because of where they are on the spectrum. And I think when people think about cure or treatment, they might be thinking about medications per se, but there's no specific treatment per se, but there are, you know, symptoms, various symptoms that may be treated with different medications. And I wanted to know how commonly you see that children who needed to be on either antipsychotics or methylphenidate or any of those.
I think both Lee and I could address this. I think it's very common for children to be on some sort of medication, but I don't know that that's always the first course of treatment. Again, I think behavioral interventions are usually what are recommended first. And as kids grow, I think they're at greater risk for depression, for anxiety. There's usually comorbid attention issues, as you said, with the stimulant medication. There's sleep issues. So it is quite common, but I think, as Leah pointed out again and again, that it's very individualized. You probably have a lot to add to.
Yeah, and I think there was a research that came out that said 60-70% of children with autism also have comorbid ADHD. And I think we see a good number of children being on ADHD medication. And then I see also as kids get older, puberty and stuff, some of their behaviors get a little bit, we see some aggression. And then seizures also, we see a lot of seizures around the age of puberty in some kids. And for that reason, some kids are put on medication. And I know in our community, there's a lot of hesitance to put on medication. And Christine said, it's not the first thing to do if there's other interventions because medication has side effects. But there comes a time when some children have to be put on medication that can benefit from medication. So with that said, there's some children that are going to be on medication down the road. And some, even at a younger age with the ADHD, they do take the medication. It helps them focus at school, it keeps them do better, be successful at school. So that's when we have to put them on medication.
Okay. Let me take one more call from area code 540-338, please.
Hi, good evening. I'm Bharata Raja. Thanks a lot for the very nice, interesting discussion. My question is that with the ASD, do you think, or what is your opinion about the lack of social interaction in the current society and the community? Both parents are working, and they are with the daycare and so on, and about the interaction with this live interaction with the siblings, and always they are dependent or they are watching TV and games and so on, where that itself is there you have lack of social interaction and communication skills, and there's no live person to correct them in the language development. Is there a possibility that a borderline ASD might have got corrected if they had grown up in a different kind of society or a home? Thank you.
That's a great question. I think that there's no doubt that our society is changing, where people are communicating in much different methods than they were 10 or 20 years ago. I think that so there's a clear impact on society, but I think in children, adolescents, adults that have ASD, there's an inability, or so there's an impairment. So I think that that needs intensive therapy to facilitate more appropriate interaction. So the difference would be that if you have a child or adolescent that is texting a lot or playing video games, and then you get them into a social environment, you do see more appropriate social behaviors. Leah, what would you?
It's interesting, yeah, because most of my boys right now, one of them is on the computer.
Right.
But for different reasons.
Yeah.
But there probably some truth with I think the fact that if they were borderline and they're not exposed to the social and rich environment, then I think that autism would get worse. I think there's some validity, I would think, to that.
Right. And then just in the diagnosis of it, that video games and texting does not, there's no research that supports that that causes autism. Absolutely.
No.
That I think that you would want kids exposed to social situations and peer interaction, and that would be very important.
And I have a kind of a related email question, somebody from Fairfax wanting to know role for holistic approach with herbal medicine, holy water, prayer,
mm-hmm.
etc. For this, what's your take on that?
Oh, no, let me take
that.
Right,
yeah, we talked about that.
Because I deal with that. Definitely, I tell parents, do what is not harmful to the child. If you feel like this is something that would help your child and it's not harmful, make sure you know what you're doing, because there's some things that are harmful. But as a whole, biomedical interventions, herbal medicine, if they're not dangerous, if it makes also the family wanting to do that. Otherwise, there's that feeling of I haven't done enough, I have to do that, so it can give them satisfaction. And in some cases, some of these biomedical, like the diet, certain vitamins, make the child even better because their diet is usually poor, they're not eating well, nutritionally they're not good, and supplementing them with vitamins and minerals and good nutrition is important. As far as religion, the holy water, definitely I tell families if that's something you want to do, it's not making your child uncomfortable, I mean, go ahead and do it. You know, it's no harm in it. What I don't like is I'm going to do holy water and I'm going to stop the intervention. That's when I say, maybe this is God's way of telling you, this is God's way of healing him also, other than just the holy water. Do everything, but do not stop intervention.
Totally agree. Totally agree with all of that.
And Leah, are you familiar with the work on autism spectrum disorder?
In Ethiopia?
Mm-hmm.
In Ethiopia, yes. I am familiar with that. There's two centers, Joy Autism Center and Nehemia Autism Center. I had an opportunity to visit Joy Autism Center in 2008. We were supporting a student there. But since then, I've had a lot of, as a group, actually, my support group supports Nehemia Autism Center because we wanted to do something for families in Ethiopia. One of the things I tell families is we're blessed to live in America where there's a lot of services that we get support and we think about people, and it's kind of healing for families to be able to lend hand to others. So we took Nehemia as a Christmas project 1 year, and we supported, we send money over there for families that are poor, for them to be able to afford other things for their children. And they're both centers are doing amazing job bringing awareness to the community and helping families, educating families. I believe Nehemia has already educated 450 families. They have 40 kids in the program, and they continue to do a lot of work. But they always tell me we need more funding and we need more resources from abroad to do the work that they're doing because there's magnitude of children waiting on that. I think 200 is what the last number that I heard Nehemia has, and even more, I believe, at Joy Autism Center, children waiting to be part of the program. So there is a lot of there's a lot of need in Ethiopia. I think about poverty and autism together. It must be really difficult because from the stories that I've heard, the parents have to go work, and what do they do with these children that are cognitively not able to take care of themselves? The schools don't have special education programs, so they leave them at home. Sometimes they have to tie them to furniture because they're for their own safety. So things are really, people are very needy in Ethiopia as far as autism and any other developmental disability.
Okay, I'm afraid we'll have to end it here. I apologize for those who are not able to get their questions through, but please forward them to info@peoplepeople.org, and I'll direct them to Leah and Christine. I'd like to thank my guest, Leah Suyum-Taspa, healthcare professional, researcher, and parent advocate for children with autism spectrum disorder and other disabilities. Thank you for your time and expertise, Leah.
Yes, thank you.
And Dr. Kristen Dooley, licensed psychologist and specialist in school psychology with extensive experience in neurodevelopmental disorders. And she's a co-author of a book on the topic and has participated in ongoing longitudinal studies related to low birth weight and prematurity. Thank you for the very informative and engaging discussion, Kristen.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And I want to thank you, the audience, for tuning in to the Global Health Forum, and we invite you to join us every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. As always, you can help shape our program by submitting your comments and suggestions through info@peoplepeople.org or People to People's Facebook page. You can also access the archived shows from previous broadcasts by using the link on the People to People website. And a program update before I sign off. Next Thursday, February 12th, Dr. Tinsai Warata will be hosting Dr. Zarasanna Alam Saget, a paleoanthropologist and chair of the anthropology department at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. Dr. Zarasanna discovered Salam, the world's oldest child at 3.3 million years. It's the most complete skeleton of the human species, Australopithecus afarensis. His work has been published in Nature, National Geographic, Scientific American, and other prominent journals, and has been a guest on CNN, PBS, and other media outlets. So make sure you mark your calendar for an up-and-close conversation with this world-renowned scientist. And please check our website for more complete listing of upcoming programs. I'm your host, Dr. Antana Hapte, and I'll be back with you the first Thursday of next month with another segment of the Global Health Forum. Thank you for your support and stay engaged.